They call him Marshall Biden.
To you, he's Mr. Vice President, but around the White House, we call him the Sheriff. Because if you're misusing taxpayer money, you'll have to answer to him.
Preventing bonanzas is Sheriff Joe Biden's job in overseeing the spending of the stimulus package. But in a program this big, someone will be writing checks and the government can't look over everyone's shoulders. Joe Biden's no stim zone on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 4th, 2009. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai today is in for Adora Udoji, who's spending time with her new baby. Good morning, Farai.
Hi, John. Coming up this hour, we're going to discuss Hillary Clinton's announcement that the U.S. will deploy two envoys to Syria. We'll also examine how some former bank executives are benefiting from buying up bad mortgages. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
U.S. military says a bomb has exploded outside of the main American base in Afghanistan. The Taliban has claimed responsibility. Several people are wounded, but no one appears to be dead. Afghanistan's election commission, in a separate story, says the presidential election should now be delayed until August. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the West Bank today. She says the U.S. is committed to addressing humanitarian needs there and in Gaza.
A child growing up in Gaza without shelter, health care, or an education has the same right to go to school, see a doctor, and live with a roof over her head as a child growing up in any country.
Secretary Clinton just concluded a joint appearance with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Farai?
Here in the U.S., U.K. Prime Minister Gordon Brown will speak about the economy before a joint session of Congress today. He foresees a global New Deal in reaction to the economic crisis.
That will involve all the countries of the world in sorting out and cleaning up the banking system. And there is the possibility of all the different countries of the world coming together to agree the expansion in the economy that is necessary.
The U.S. stimulus package alarmed Britain last month. It included a measure that favors American companies over foreign competitors. Meanwhile, President Obama will talk about federal contracts this morning. He says they waste taxpayer dollars. This comes after a White House financial summit last week in which lawmakers said contracts needed to be handled in a better way. And the armed insurgents, the armed agents who raided Ukraine's national gas company today were national security agents. They questioned a top accountant in connection with a criminal investigation about the diversion of $900 million worth of gas.
They just lost it. The Dow and S&P both fell 0.6% yesterday. The Dow closed at 67.26. The S&P begins trading this morning, and the futures market suggests that trading will be up in the early going. The S&P begins at 696. So the stimulus bill is done. The checks are being written. Shovels already hitting the ground. What are you being promised in your town? We're crowdsourcing your answers for our Shovel Watch project, and we want to know what you've been promised. High-speed rail, new jobs, new schools. What are you getting? What are you seeing? And do you think the stimulus promised your town or city is going to work? Is it even going to be spent properly? What do you actually need? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or write to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Shovels ready?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai Chidea is in for Adora Udoji here in the studio. Well, hello once again.
Yes, thank you.
Lots to talk about this morning. We're going to begin in the Middle East. Hillary Clinton is in the region. She just finished a joint appearance with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president. But about mid-morning yesterday, you may not have noticed it, but there was an announcement from the Secretary of State that came as a bit of a surprise.
We're going to dispatch a representative of the State Department and representative of the White House to explore with Syria some of these bilateral issues. And we have no way to predict what the future with our relations concerning Syria might be. But I think it is a worthwhile effort to go and begin these preliminary conversations.
Well, the key words in diplomatic speak there, preliminary, no way to predict, which might suggest no preconditions, and bilateral issues. What are some of those issues? Two envoys to Syria to see if there's a possibility of some flexibility in the Syrian position on, say, Lebanon or on its relationship with Israel, the dispute over the Golan Heights territory. To help us understand the significance of this announcement and the use of dual envoys, we're joined now by Richard Murphy, who was U.S. ambassador to Syria between 1974 and 1978. He's been a Middle East analyst since then, and he joins us this morning from Saudi Arabia. Ambassador Murphy, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, John.
Explain to me, first of all, if this constitutes a raising of the profile of Syria on the part of the Obama administration, simply the naming of two envoys and the announcement that they're both going to have exploratory talks with the Syrian government.
Oh, I wouldn't say raising the profile. I'd say that it's part of the Obama administration's efforts to reach out and explore what's possible to reactivate the peace process overall in the Middle East. And Syria is certainly going to be, if it moves at all, it's going to be a key player.
Would you say that the potential for movement on the part of the Syrian government under Bashar Assad, who, of course, is the son of Hafez al-Assad, the notoriously inflexible and so-called strongman leader of Syria for so many years, has Bashar really been tested to see what the limits of his tolerance for change might be?
Well, he's been in power now since the death of his father, and that takes us back to, I believe, 2000. So he's had several years' experience on the job, and well, I last saw him a few years back. He was saying he felt he had ample scope for leadership. So at that point in time, people were questioning whether he had simply been put into the office, and he was surrounded by the old guard that his father had built. But after this period of time, I think he is his own man, and he's expressing an interest in improved relations with the West, and he's been going through peace talks indirectly with Israel under Turkish sponsorship for the past year or more.
Explain to me the significance of the two big issues in the region that have Syria directly at the center. There's the dispute over the Golan Heights with Israel that undoubtedly is at the center of talks mediated by Turkey that you've just referred to. And what about the investigation into the assassination of Mr. Hariri in Lebanon and the withdrawal from Lebanon by Syria? Which, regionally speaking, is more important from the U.S. perspective as we send these representatives into Syria?
Well, you know, the tribunal, the investigation of the assassination of Rafiq Hariri is going ahead. It opened in Holland on Sunday. That will be pursued. It apparently is going to be a very thorough process, which could take a few years. The position that Syria has stuck to for years, ever since, throughout Hafez Assad's regime, was that every last bit of the Syrian territory occupied by Israel in the Six-Day War must be returned to Syria before he could contemplate a peace and work out a peace settlement with Israel. It's a sine qua non, the return of all the territory occupied. I don't think that his son is about to alter that position. That is absolutely central to Syria. What the Israelis and what the Americans have been wondering is what would be the content that Syria would be willing to put into a peaceful relationship with Israel. And those are some of the issues that are going to have to be explored.
Well, let's talk about the possibility of clout then with Syria. Do you think that the U.S. is capable of bringing a Golan Heights conclusion actually to the signing point? And what about Saudi Arabia? I mean, you are in Saudi Arabia right now. Certainly Syria, without any fossil fuel resources of its own, is heavily dependent upon other regional players. Might they have influence on bringing a settlement to fruition between Syria and Israel?
Well, my sense is that Syria is interested in getting out of the isolated situation that it has, quite frankly, put itself into over the years. It's had very irritable relations with Saudi Arabia, with Egypt, with a large number of countries, and I think that its leadership is now looking for a better relationship. I believe the Saudis are ready to reciprocate. The Syrian foreign minister has been down visiting Riyadh. He called on King Abdullah about a week ago, and the signs are that both sides are interested in forgetting some of the issues, or not letting them stand in the way of an improved relationship. Syria has not had aid from Saudi Arabia. It has had some aid, some investment from Iran in recent years. But Syria's economy goes on fairly steadily, not very dramatic. It has limited oil, still exporting oil. So it's not totally dependent on foreign assistance at this point.
Ambassador, this is Farai Chidea sitting in with John. I'm wondering how you contextualize the U.S. diplomacy in general at this point, with Secretary of State Clinton traveling through Israel and the region around it. Would you say that what you know so far from observing the Obama administration, will they be active or proactive in the region, or are they going to simply talk to leaders and take a wait-and-see approach?
I'll be frank. I've been surprised at how active they have been. The number of initiatives, starting with the president's own visit to the State Department on the second day of his administration, the appointment of George Mitchell, his two trips, he's on his second now, this time accompanying Secretary Clinton. One could say, look, that's just symbolism. The serious contacts have yet to begin. But they have made an astonishingly quick beginning, and I welcome it, because I think we have unnecessarily cut ourselves off in our diplomatic in our diplomacy over the last several years from countries such as Syria.
Well, let's look back at Syria then. Is there a possibility, given what you've just said about the active nature of the Obama style of diplomacy going forward, do you think there's a chance for a breakthrough on Hamas, on Syria's relationship with Hamas, influence on Hamas that might actually produce something of substance in the Gaza dispute? Is Syria likely to be flexible there?
There's certainly a possibility of flexibility, but what will not work is preconditioning Syrian moves on Hamas, on its relations with Hezbollah, on its relations with Iran, as a prelude to any serious conversations with the United States. I'm convinced they would like better relationships with the United States and with the West generally, but they're going to be cautious. What's in it for Syria? They're good bargainers. The bazaar has gone on for centuries in the Middle East, and we are just now reopening it with Syria.
Let the bargaining begin. A good takeaway there from the announcement yesterday of two envoys might be look for a possible quid pro quo, better relations with the United States in return for some kind of signal on more flexibility regarding the Syrian relationship with Hamas, maybe as even a starting point. Richard Murphy, former U.S. ambassador to Syria between 1974 and 1978, joined us for a discussion of the development that two envoys are going to Syria to explore the possibility of flexibility on a number of so-called bilateral issues. He joined us from Saudi Arabia.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Over the next few weeks, we will launch more than 200 construction projects across this country, fueling growth in an industry that's been hard hit by our economic crisis. Altogether, this investment in highways will create or save 150,000 jobs by the end of next year.
That was President Obama speaking yesterday in Washington. I'm Farai Chidea. Federal agencies were required to start weekly reports on what they're doing with stimulus money yesterday. The information will appear on a new website, recovery.gov, and it's run by the Federal Office of Management and Budget. Many Americans hope this $800 billion will be spent with more transparency than the bank bailout, but the new online reports could reveal less than you might think. Joining us to discuss the actual level of transparency is Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein. She's also the director of our Shovel Watch project. So we're going to be seeing every dollar on recovery.gov, right?
Well, not exactly. And first of all, let me say good morning, Farai, and it's so great to have you on The Takeaway. I'm a huge fan of yours on News and Notes, or I was. So
thank you.
Delightful to have you in this format. Now, every
Andrea,
dollar.
You're so nice, Andrea.
But it's true. It's true. Every dollar is the rhetoric. And as a matter of fact, in an email exchange yesterday with a spokesperson for the Department of OMB, I just heard the same thing. But actually, no. And there's a memo that Budget Director Peter Orszag released a couple weeks ago in which he explicitly says that you only have to go down two levels of money. Now, I know this sounds slightly wonky, but hey, I'm going to tap into everybody's inner wonk. The way it works now is that if the federal government gives money to a big state, say Georgia, Georgia has to declare everybody it gives money to. So Georgia might hire ABC Road Construction to fix a bridge or repave a road. But Georgia might also send some money to the city of Atlanta, in which case Atlanta is the subcontractor. And then guess what? The money stops there. So the city of Atlanta doesn't have to tell you, according to the current law and regulations, where it's spending the money. And you can only imagine the giant loopholes that will be caused by this, unless some states and cities take on their own initiative. But as of now, we're a far cry from every dollar.
So the states don't have to report some subcontractors. What about the cities? And what about, you know, receipts?
Well, unfortunately, as it's written now, no receipts, no contracts. My understanding is the only way to get a contract from the federal government is to ask for it under the Freedom of Information Law. And, you know, cities are even more confusing. You take a big city like Atlanta or St. Louis or New York, and in theory, they could go out and they could hire concrete boots to repave their road. And, you know, this may sound a little frivolous, but the construction industry is not exactly known nationally as the most corruption-free industry. They would not have to post this on recovery.gov. Now, some states are taking matters into their own hands. So if you go right now to the national website, the recovery.gov, and we have a link to it on the takeaway.org, some states have already posted information, and some of them on their own, like the city of New York, says it will be actually post all of the spending. So there will be sort of a patchwork of local initiatives, but the national sort of effort to look at all this money is falling a little short.
Although, Andrea, isn't the intent of the federal government to create an incentive structure for states to, if Joe Biden is asking the states, all right, where did the money go? And the states just kind of say, well, we gave it to the subcontractors, that was what we did. I mean, that's just not going to look real good for them. And that the incentive is for then the states to be the enforcers at the subcontractor level. And I'm wondering, you know, who's the kingmaker here in the way this structure is playing out? Who's the person who's in the position of creating a giant patronage army of contractors and projects with the money, invisibly located in their desk drawers?
Well, look, I mean, you know, you've got a real on the one hand, on the other hand situation. And like a lot of parts of this stimulus bill, how it works in practice is actually currently being negotiated and currently being worked out. So even though there's already a bill, we don't exactly know how it's all going to happen. But, you know, I mean, I think that the sort of disgust with the bank bailout and how that money was spent and how little people knew about it and, you know, the big bonuses and the commodes and, you know, all of this money being spent in the banking industries has given rise to, I think, what is a positive trend in this country, which is, you know, it's usually just a sort of a few of us, you know, kind of government watchdog types that are really excited about transparency. Now the whole country is. And, you know, on the one hand, there is this website to track the money. On the other hand, it is yet to be settled whether this is public relations, this is about reassuring people, or this is an actual mechanism to, you know, really give Americans access to the dollars. And, you know, one of the things that we're doing in our Shovel Watch project is really trying to keep them honest and saying, you know, we're watching, so we'd like to make sure that you do too.
Well, just very briefly, the sheriff is the nickname that the president has given the Vice President Joe Biden. You know, is he an enforcer type? I think of that as a Rahm Emanuel role.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's also Eric Devaney that's been hired as sort of the Elizabeth Warren of the stimulus bill to really sort of watch how the money is spent. I mean, I do think that this is all part of, you know, the reassurance. And, you know, to be fair, economists say that boosting people's confidence is part of what this bill is about. It's not just about spending money, you know. But when it gets down to all these cities and states and all these authorities, the New York Thruway Authority and the California Bridge Authority and all of these transit authorities, it goes into some murky areas. We'll be tracking it on shovelwatch.org, and we
Great.
Hope that people will also be giving us information about their projects on our website.
Absolutely, Andrea, and great to talk to you. That was Andrea Bernstein, takeaway correspondent and director of our Shovel Watch project. And now we have Femi Okeh with the news.
At 28 minutes past the hour, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the West Bank meeting with Palestinian leaders, including President Mahmoud Abbas. She pledged U.S. support for peace in the Middle East.
The Obama administration will be vigorously engaged in efforts to forge a lasting peace between Israel, the Palestinians, and all of the Arab neighbors.
This is Secretary Clinton's first visit to the region in her role as top U.S. diplomat. Britain's Prime Minister is going before Congress today. Gordon Brown will tell lawmakers to have more faith in the free market. Meeting with Brown at the White House yesterday, the president emphasized the unique bond between the UK and the United States. Federal investigators are continuing their review of a train collision in California last year. It killed 25 people. They say there were no signs of mechanical failure to explain a head-on crash between a Metrolink passenger train and a Union Pacific freight train. You may remember this train crash because it was the one where the train driver was believed to have been texting on his cell phone.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I am Farai Chidea in for Adora. The stimulus bill is done, the checks are being written, and the shovels are hitting the ground. What are you being promised in your town? We're crowdsourcing your answers for our Shovel Watch project and want to know what you've been promised. High-speed rail, new jobs, new schools. What are you getting? What are you seeking? Do you think the stimulus promised your town or city is going to work? And what do you actually need? Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or write to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
Sometimes I think I need a shovel with all this talk about stimulus, but not for the thing that you might expect. It's shoveling something else that I believe is coming out of Washington. But that's another story. Just a few months ago, thinking about the economy, you know, it seemed like you couldn't get away from messages like this.
Homeowners, want to get cash and simplify your bills? Ask about a combo loan from Countrywide.
We're America's number one home loan lender. No one can do what Countrywide can.
No one can do what Countrywide can.
Well, Countrywide can't do much anymore. It's a subsidiary of Bank of America when it was bought. But there's a new company in town called PennyMac. You may not have heard of it yet. But some of the brains behind Countrywide Financial have begun buying up delinquent home mortgages, often for just pennies on the dollar, from the U.S. government. And the bad bank toxic assets that the government sells them become profitable with the right amount of coaxing and sort of business acumen. Helping to explain what this is all about and how it possibly is a pathway out of the housing bottom, New York Times reporter Eric Lipton joins us from Washington, D.C. He's been covering the emergence of this company, PennyMac, on the financial scene, and you can find his story in today's New York Times. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Now, let's talk about, first of all, how this works. Some of the people who were responsible for some of these subprime mortgages or very, very liberal mortgage terms are now buying so-called bad mortgages and turning them into something not so bad. How does it work?
Right. There's about a dozen former Countrywide executives that have joined together in the same exact town where Countrywide was based, Calabasas, outside of Los Angeles, and they've set up this new company that they call PennyMac, and they're buying up these delinquent mortgages. And because they buy them at such a low price, they're able to offer their borrower a much lower interest rate, or even in some cases reduce their principal, and still earn a very hefty profit if the borrower repays the loan.
So it's conceivable that somebody got a loan from Countrywide, maybe even years ago. It bounced around the securitized market, maybe sold to someone in Taiwan or ended up in a European bank, and then made its way back to the United States where it became a toxic asset on the balance of, say, AIG, okay? The federal government sells it to PennyMac, who may have been, you know, some of the people might have been the original underwriter of the Countrywide loan. They buy it for pennies on the dollar. And then what do they do to the actual mortgage, you know, the person who actually is supposed to be making the payments? Do they call them up and offer them new terms?
They do. And it's a very sort of, you know, friendly, we're here to help you kind of approach. And they actually are using a lot of the popular marketing techniques that they had at Countrywide, which allowed them to grow so much. And so far, just to let you know, the PennyMac does not look as if it actually has acquired former Countrywide loans.
Right.
It has loans from a failed bank in Nevada, First National Bank of Nevada, that went under in July, and the federal government, the FDIC, took over all of its bad debt, and that is the bulk of what PennyMac has so far. It also has a bunch of bad loans from Lehman Brothers, another unfortunate story. It collects these loans, it calls the owners of the loans, and it tries to negotiate with them. If necessary, it will foreclose upon the loans and essentially force the people out of their homes or properties.
But if the payments resume and they're able to renegotiate the terms, a certain kind of financial magic happens where suddenly the asset that they bought for pennies on the dollar becomes worth a whole lot more. How does that work?
The profit margins for them are really enormous. I mean, they convinced one Massachusetts homeowner to do a short sale, which is to sell his property for less than it was worth. And this gentleman sold his property for less than half its value. And PennyMac still made, you know, something like 100% profit on what it had paid for his loan. It's because they're buying the bulk loans at such a cheap price that they can offer all these apparent, you know, great deals to the borrower and still come out way ahead.
Eric, this is Farai Chidea. I've been reading recently about some cases in which people who have been put through the foreclosure process, they've had their loans transferred so many times, and along the way there have been paperwork problems, et cetera, and in fact, some of these people may not be in foreclosure. In a big business play like that, is it at all concerning to folks like this who already have a in some cases, not great reputation with the public? Will people start to investigate whether or not the folks getting foreclosed on really have been properly targeted?
Well, in fact, I was in their offices for a whole day, and I stood there as the operators were talking to some of the people that have their loans now at PennyMac. And, they are actually pretty good at handling these people, and they can offer more than their former bank was willing to offer. And they don't want to foreclose because, in fact, foreclosure is a pretty expensive process for them. They could make more money if they could simply get the people to start paying again.
Right.
So their preference is to avoid foreclosure, and they are quite successful at doing it because if they could knock your interest rate from 7% to 3%, your monthly payments are going to, be cut almost in half, and you're going to be happy. They're going to be happy because they're making money. The only party that's not happy is probably, is the federal government to some extent because it's eating that loss.
Exactly. I mean, Eric, just very quickly, a couple of seconds, isn't the federal government supposed to be doing this? Aren't they the ones who are supposed to be realizing this profit because it's taxpayer money?
Well, in fact, the federal government does get in 80% of the money that PennyMac collects, they get. But again, still that sounds a lot.
Right.
But PennyMac is still making 20%, and that's a lot of money for it to share among its partners.
Living along the bottom, PennyMac. Is it a bottom feeder? Who knows what it is, but interesting business proposition explained by Eric Lipton from the New York Times. And now Femi Okeh has the headlines.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, an international arrest warrant is out for Sudan's president. He's being charged with crimes against humanity and war crimes. The International Criminal Court warrant doesn't include genocide charges. That's because the three-judge panel said there wasn't enough evidence to support those charges. Around 300,000 people have died and almost 3 million displaced in Sudan's Darfur region since 2003. Dutch investigators say that a faulty altimeter played a role in the crash of a Turkish airliner last week. The plane was coming into Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport carrying 135 passengers. 9 people died, including 4 Americans.
It's the altimeter, right? The altitude meter, right?
Yes, okay. Altitude meter. I should just split it up. It would be so much easier. Thank you for clarifying
that.
That's all right. Ukrainian national security agents raided the headquarters of the country's troubled natural gas company today. They are investigating the alleged diversion of gas en route to Europe. Russia repeatedly accused Ukraine of siphoning off natural gas worth around $900 million. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome, John.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea.
Athletes, I love this story.
This is fascinating. It's about sports, and it's about achievement, and it's about the unexpected. So athletes across all sports can get better at everything, it seems. But on the front page of today's New York Times, we learn one thing hasn't changed in decades of basketball from college to the NBA, men and women. Joining us now, we've got John Branch, sports writer for The Times, our partner. Now, this may be beyond basic, but it's about free throws. And for folks who don't know basketball, what's a free throw and how can it swing a game?
Hello, Farai. The free throw is the reward that you get when you're fouled and you get a 15-foot shot worth one point.
So you get a chance to throw, and it's all about accuracy. So what does this new study show about the accuracy rate of free throws?
Well, it's funny. We kind of stumbled across this. The accuracy rate in the NBA has been just about 75% for about 50 years, more than 50 years. And in the NCAA, college basketball, it's been about 69% for about the same amount of time, which we thought was just incredible, as you suggest, that, most sports, we expect people to get better and better at them. It happens across every other sport, just about. And here's the most basic function in basketball. Shooting a free throw, you're unguarded. You should be able to get better, you would think, as a group. Athletes seem to be better in basketball than they were 50 years ago. And it has remained remarkably consistent. And it'd be one thing if it went down for a little bit or went up for a while, but it has stayed so consistent that it really struck us as strange.
Well, you know, you've got marathoners running faster, swimmers breaking records. Baseball's another whole story. Why do we think that the free throw is frozen in achievement?
Well, the statisticians will tell you that it's, you know, several things might have to take place before athletes get better in a certain sport. And one of those things might be physiologically they're better athletes, maybe even they're drug-enhanced better athletes. For example, in free throw shooting, it doesn't really matter if you're strong, if you're tall, if you're short, if you're weak. None of those things come to play, whereas maybe in swimming, for example, these athletes are probably better athletes than they were 50 years ago. In free throw shooting, it doesn't matter. Technology has not changed in free throw shooting. It's still a ball. It's still a rim hung 10 feet above the court, 15 feet away. Whereas technology has certainly advanced many other sports.
Well, John, you're making Shaquille O'Neal feel good this morning because he has the worst percentage of the major players in the NBA, something like that. I guess it doesn't matter, right?
That's right. You know, it's funny. I'm glad you brought up Shaquille. It's funny about him because he has had his rate fluctuate himself anywhere from 64% or so down to the upper 40s. He's had a free throw coach, which it helped for a while. I mean, anybody can improve free throws if they work on their technique, if they use a lot of repetition. But they usually fall back to whatever they are normally going to shoot. And for Shaquille, it's somewhere in the 50% range.
Well, John,
he has scored 27,000 points in his career. Had he just been an average free throw shooter, he would have another 2,500 points in his career.
All right, John, that's all we've got time for. Thanks so much. That was John Branch, sports writer for The New York Times.
I love that. So the fact that I can't make a free throw doesn't matter.
Yeah, I was terrible at it. I'm in good company.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, the importance of not looking down, economically speaking. But first, headlines from Femi Okay.
Good morning. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The U.S. military says that a bomb has exploded outside of the main American base in Afghanistan. Several people are wounded, but one appears to be dead. The Taliban claim responsibility. Meanwhile, Afghanistan's election commission says that the presidential election should be delayed until August. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the West Bank today meeting with Palestinian leaders. Secretary Clinton talked to the press after her meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
The United States supports the Palestinian Authority as the only legitimate government of the Palestinian people and as a partner on the road to a comprehensive peace, which includes a two-state solution.
Secretary Clinton also praised the Palestinian Authority's plan for rebuilding Gaza, which was unveiled earlier this week. The Sri Lankan cricket team has arrived back home from Pakistan after masked gunmen opened fire on their bus and its police escort yesterday. Team captain Malhela Jahawardenu says that his teammates are still in shock.
We went through all this and I can't even think anything other than that, just that everyone's safe. A lot of guys were really lucky. To be honest with you, there were bullet holes in our bus everywhere. If you see the bus, there's not a place that there hasn't been a bullet hole. I honestly don't know how we escaped all this.
Gunmen wounded 7 players and killed 6 police officers guarding them. Pakistani police have arrested about 20 people for involvement with the attack on the Sri Lankan cricket team. And that's a look at some of the big stories.
Hold, on there, Femi. I've got a question for you. Gordon Brown's going to speak to Congress later today,
right?
The UK Prime Minister?
Yes.
Any chance that Barack Obama, they've been meeting a lot,
yes,
is going to say to the press sometime next week,
we give you back America?
No. Brownie's doing a hell of a job.
No, that's not going to happen.
I like we give you back America. <It's good. laughs> We can barely take care of it.
But I do love brownies.
Brownies, yes, that's right. Well, he's not Brownie, but he is the UK Prime Minister, and he speaks to Congress later today. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
I feel as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well.
Is that how you feel? The depressing slide of the Dow Jones Industrial Average and even the biggest, savviest investors taking major hits. And if you watch the financial channels, you can hear it from time to time, especially last fall. Big billionaires coming in and calling a bottom to the market. And then, as it continued to slide, losing billions. There's Sheikh Al-Waleed and all his holdings in Citibank. There's Warren Buffett, who suggested we all buy stock several months ago. And if we had, how mad would we be at Warren Buffett? But listen to this. Barack Obama yesterday, maybe, possibly, was he calling a bottom in the stock market?
Profit and earning ratios are starting to get to the point where buying stocks is a potentially good deal if you've got a long-term perspective on it.
The keywords there, potentially and long-term perspective. I think it's unfair to say Barack Obama was calling a bottom, but many have tried. Few have mastered it. Ben Stieverman is a reporter with BusinessWeek.com. He joins us from Chicago. This calling a bottom business is as mysterious as it is, quite frankly, stupid, right?
Right. It's something that has burned investors over and over and over again.
And give us some examples in this current period where, you know, the bottoms have come and gone on the way from whatever it is, 13,000 on the Dow down to below 7,000.
Well, traders and stock investors love to look for levels where the stock market might stop its slide. And they try to make these predictions based on past history or based on earnings, which was something that Barack Obama was talking about yesterday. So there was some thought that we would hold at the lows of the last recession, which was 2002-2003. We didn't. And then we fell to, in November, we fell to a very low level, and I think we all remember where the stock market was then, and that was really scary. And then we had a big rally when Barack Obama started to take office, and he announced a new Treasury Secretary, and there was hope that some of these problems would get sorted out. And then right in February, the floor fell out again, and here we are back to the lowest level, new lows, just yesterday. So investors got burned again over that kind of Christmas period, the last few months.
Well, Ben, take a listen to this. This is a very famous statement by a very famous guy who I guess he wasn't trying to call a bottom exactly, but what was he trying to call here?
How do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values?
Was he calling a top there in the market in 1996? I should point out that the averages are all below where Alan Greenspan, the Fed chairman at that time, said we were reaching a top in the market.
You know, and calling a top is just as hard as calling a bottom. When he made that statement, the stock still had a few more years to run up before the tech boom. So if you taken his advice at that point, you would have lost out on a lot of money. You know, we have better examples in the last 30 years of people incorrectly calling a top, though. And people, you know, plenty of people were saying buy tech stock, buy technology stocks in the early 2000s, right before the boom busted. But the fact is, in the last 30 years, the bottoms in the stock market have been relatively temporary, and we've had an ability to kind of bounce off those bottoms pretty easily. And usually, if you jumped in at those moments, you made a lot of money. But unfortunately, this seems to be a different kind of stock market, and the parallels here are more with the 1930s, where you had the stocks would hit a bottom, and the stocks fell 86% from 1929 to 1932. The stocks would hit a bottom, and then they'd rally, and then they'd fall again, and then they'd rally, and then they'd fall again, and really nobody made any money in the stock market in the entire decade of the 1930s.
Ben, this is Farai. One thing that strikes me is that we mere mortals have to make decisions about our money, whether it's moving money within, you know, retirement accounts or liquidating things. Or, I mean, what kind of a psychological impact do you think it has on people when you see this happening? You don't really completely understand what's going on, and you have some urgency to make some financial decisions.
Well, I think the key for people who aren't in the game, and even people who are in the game, really don't understand what's going on. And I think that's an important thing for people to realize, is that nobody has this figured out. But I think when people talk about focusing on the long term and not focusing on the day by day or month by month movements of the stock market, they really have it right. If you buy stocks now, you're not buying them at the bottom, but you're buying them at a fairly low level. And if you're investing for the long term, and by long term, I think I mean 10 years at least, if you're buying for the long term, stocks are probably a pretty good buy at this point. I think that,
assuming the companies stay in business, though, Ben, that's sort of the issue. Let me just, before we go, ask you, the assumption in that is that we're going to come down to some bottom and smoothly go back up again, that there's a business cycle at work here. But what if it's not a cycle? What if there is some sort of discontinuity here, and you can't just put this on a chart of cycles of the past?
Well, I think that when you talk about the Saudi princes and the oil billionaires from the Gulf who've invested all this money in, for example, Citigroup, you're talking about people who bought into a company that they thought was the premier bank in the world, and it turns out, well, it's not, and it might not even survive, or it might not survive in the same form. When you're investing in the entire U.S. stock market, you're investing in the entire U.S. economy, and you just hope. That the U.S. economy is going to continue.
Say it together now. You just hope the U.S.
economy will continue.
Ben Steverman, thanks so much. Ben Steverman is a reporter with BusinessWeek.com talking about the bottom and how difficult it is to find or calculate. Okay, the stimulus bill is done. The checks are being written. Shovels hitting the ground. What are you being promised in your town? I want to remind you of the Shovel Watch Project. What have you been promised? High-speed rail, new jobs? What's working or not in your community regarding the stimulus package? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And here's your takeaway.
They're buying the bulk loans at such a cheap price that they can offer all these apparent great deals to the borrower and still come out way ahead.
Sound like a good deal? Well, it sure does to PennyMac, the ex-brains behind Countrywide Financial, making money off of toxic assets. That's the New York Times' Eric Lipton talking about the emergence of this PennyMac, sort of son of Countrywide.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is, of course, The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Imagine things getting this bad.
I'm suggesting that the government should step in and regulate all mortgage lending in Ohio and the country so that we're not facing this.
The government stepping in and controlling all mortgage lending in the U.S.? Cleveland City Councilman Tony Brancatelli called that back in December of 2007. It took a year for the government to see the devastation that has been visible on the streets of cities like Cleveland for years. Bad loan, ghost town, streets with only names. Cul-de-sac, hit the brakes. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 4th, 2009. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai today is in for Adora Udoji, who's spending time with her new baby. Good morning, Farai.
Hi, John. Coming up this hour, we're going to take a look at how homeowners are dealing with property that's now almost worthless. We'll also discuss the battle for Rahm Emanuel's seat in Congress and talk about what organic certification says about food safety. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for sitting Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. He's charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. Judges said there was not enough evidence to support charges of genocide. The Taliban claimed responsibility for a car bomb that exploded outside of the main American base in Afghanistan today. Three people wounded, no one killed. Meanwhile, Afghanistan's election commission says the presidential election should be delayed now until August, against the wishes of President Karzai. Farai?
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the West Bank today. She's been emphasizing the importance of peace negotiations there, but she also says the U.S. knows when to back off.
We all know and respect that, in the end, it is up to the parties themselves to make peace. We offer you our support. Not just today, but for all the tomorrows to come until the goal is realized.
The West Bank is Clinton's last major stop on her tour of the Middle East. She heads to Brussels later today. Here in the U.S., U.K. Prime Minister Gordon Brown will speak about the economy before a joint session of Congress today. He says repairing credit markets is key to rolling back the global recession.
We've got to underwrite the financial system so that loans can start again to businesses and families. And we've got to get enough lending into the economy so that people, enough credit, so that people are able to go about the normal business again.
Gordon Brown talked economics with President Obama yesterday. He wants all the world's economies to stimulate their economies according to a common set of principles.
Also, within the hour, it's believed President Obama will talk about federal contracts this morning. He wants to change the way they are awarded. There's also going to be more details today about a $75 billion plan to help mortgage owners stay in their homes. Investigators say a faulty altimeter played a role in the crash of a Turkish Airlines plane that crashed near Amsterdam last week. That's the device that tells the pilot how high the plane is. The Dow and S&P both fell 0.6% yesterday. It looks like a positive opening on Wall Street. The S&P begins trading at $6.96. So eating healthy doesn't mean eating organic anymore. What is your strategy for keeping your food supply healthy? Is it buying organic? Is it only taking certain kinds of packaging? Give us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai today is in here for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Farai.
How you doing?
So the government's going to reveal more details about this homeowner plan, a way of keeping mortgage holders in their homes if they're getting close to foreclosure. But the details of the $75 billion plan announced today are probably not going to be of much help to many, many people who are already out of their homes and neighborhoods around the country that are dealing with real difficulties. I mean, when we look at the write-down of toxic assets, so-called, in America, they represent, each one of those numbers represents devastation in neighborhoods all over the country. Think of Cleveland. Here's Judge Raymond Pianca, Cuyahoga County Housing Court judge, speaking on the public radio station in Cleveland, describing that devastation and what it has meant to the people of that city.
So we're seeing people from all over the country purchasing properties online, and many of them have never been to Cleveland, Ohio, do not know what the real estate dynamics are here, and unfortunately, the citizens many time are forced to maintain the property, cut the grass, board them up, and demolish the properties in certain cases, all without consequence to the owners who are across the country and in some cases in Canada and elsewhere.
Judge Pianca is describing a trade in essentially dead properties, abandoned houses and land in Cleveland that's the result of the wholesale collapse of the housing market in that struggling manufacturing community, with a profile of Cleveland in the New York Times magazine and with long-standing experience in covering urban issues. Alex Kotlowitz now joins us. He's a contributor to the New York Times magazine and author of the legendary book, There Are No Children Here. He teaches writing at Northwestern University. He joins us from Oak Park, Illinois. Alex, Cleveland is a land of devastation, true?
It is. I went out there and I knew that they had been hit hard and hit early, but I was staggered by what the sort of wreckage is left behind by the foreclosure crisis. And I say left behind, and I think it's too early to even call it the aftermath.
Right. We're definitely in the middle of it. And one of the characters that you found out there, I wonder if you recognize the voice of this individual. Alex, listen.
The industry that's out there now in the subprime market, basically, these are renegade mortgage companies. They thought they figured out a way to put together portfolios of loans and put them on Wall Street. And what they figured out was a way for people to abuse the practices. And I'm suggesting that the government should step in and regulate all mortgage lending in Ohio, in the country, so that we're not facing this.
It's Tony Brancatelli, councilman of Ward 12 in the city of Cleveland, basically back in December of 2007, calling for government intervention in the mortgage market, something that has definitely come to pass. He's ahead of his time, but it's not a happy thing, is it, Alex?
No, I mean, Tony's even said to me, the sad thing is, they were calling for government intervention back as early as 2001. As Tony said to me recently, he said he's now lowered his standards. I mean, he's in some ways has his finger in the dike. He's just trying to keep his community from collapsing. He told me last we spoke that they were experiencing in his ward alone 2 foreclosures every day.
What does that look like? You've walked through these streets, you've been in the houses and peered out of the windowless openings in them. What does it look like?
Well, you go down one street. I spent time on this one 2-block stretch, East 113th Street. Of 70 homes on that 2-block stretch, somewhere between 29 to 35 houses are vacant and abandoned. And I estimate, because it's a little hard to tell with some of them, many of them, what happens in Cleveland, as soon as those houses go to sheriff's sale, the scavengers come in, they rip out the copper pipes, the electrical wires, the mechanics of the house, the hot water furnace, the boiler, they strip the aluminum siding. And what's kind of astonishing to me, they're even taking the cement slabs now from the front steps. I mean, it's as if the city has literally had its legs knocked out from under them. And the other problem is that most of these houses, I shouldn't say most, but so many of them are just wide open. Wide open to squatters, to teenagers, to gang members, and they have an enormous arson problem. Tony in his ward last year had over 60 arson fires of vacant houses, and they have no idea what it is. I think he thinks it may be vigilantes. I think in some ways he's projecting, because I think he'd like to see a lot of these houses himself just disappear.
Alex, you have a scene in this rendering of this community that is pretty amazing, talking to the council person about seeing a woman lying on the ground. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, I remember one morning I was in Cleveland, and it was early in the morning, and Tony called me on his cell phone, and he was all excited. I hadn't heard him quite that excited in the time I'd spent with him, and he told me that he had been out that morning checking out 2 vacant houses that we had just been to the previous week. And he said that while he was there, he looked at the yard next door, and he thought there was a woman lying on the ground. And he, of course, was alarmed and went over to check. And it turns out it was a 81-year-old woman with one leg who was on the ground whacking away at weeds with a hatchet and putting them into a cardboard box to be picked up as refuge the next day for garbage pickup. And he was just so excited, and he said to me, "My God, what fortitude!" And for me, it just was sort of brought home that he was really looking for hope, some sign of normal life in his community. And this was it, this 81-year-old, one-legged woman whacking away at weeds with a hatchet.
Wow. You know, the market is cruel. It was cruel on the way up, and it's cruel on the way down. And though you describe the scavenging of these vacant homes for parts and pieces that are sold on some sort of an aftermarket, in many ways, this is also the continuing working of the market. It sounds like lawlessness, but in fact, that's what happens in situations like this, whether you're talking about, you know, Central Africa or Australia or downtown Cleveland.
Right. And, you know, there was a period, it's not no longer, when scrap prices were at astronomical prices. And the irony is all that scrap went to places like Mumbai and Beijing. I mean, basically, those cities for a number of years were built at the expense of ours.
And so the copper pipe was scavenged from Cleveland homes and probably sold on a scrap market that ended up in China.
Not probably, but it was. I mean, I've talked to the scrap association, and that's where all the scrap was going. It was going to India, to China, and to Russia, and to build their cities.
What about the issue of raising houses? You know, in Baltimore, where I grew up, there's been a lot of controversy over whether you can use knocking down decrepit houses as a form of urban renewal. Right. You talk about some of the figures. What's going on across the country?
Well, there, last summer, the Congress appropriated $3 billion under what they call the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. And some cities like Cleveland and I believe Baltimore lobbied fairly vigorously to be allowed to use some of that money to raise houses. And so there are a number of communities, Cleveland included, that are using, you know, upwards of half of their money to tear down houses under the belief that these houses are now, you know, simply unsalvageable, and that we might as well have this vacant land, and when things improve, we can begin to sort of reimagine how our city might look.
The housing money is used, Cleveland, they've
lost so many people.
Right.
I mean, the county, Cuyahoga County, has lost about the same number of people that, that New Orleans Parish has lost since Hurricane Katrina.
Well, the irony of using housing money to demolish homes is certainly chilling. I mean, you know, for so long, whether we're talking about Jack Kemp, politicians like the former heads of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, even Bill Clinton for a long time spoke of home ownership as a kind of symbol of security and being a stakeholder in a neighborhood and a community. Do you think that sense of home ownership has been sort of tarnished, stained forever as a result of experiences like what you found in Cleveland?
Well, hopefully it hasn't been tarnished forever. But, you know, for me, what was most remarkable about Cleveland, when I went out there, I initially thought that the question that most intrigued me was what's happened to everybody. And I, you know, was calling all the homeless shelters and the schools. And for me, as I began to spend some time in the city, what was most remarkable to me weren't the people that had left, but the people who had stayed, and their homeowners, you know, people who had bought these homes 30, 40 years ago and simply were not going to let go of what they had. And it really, for me, brought home sort of, no pun intended, but brought home, I mean, the sort of importance and essential nature of having a place of your own.
Well, just having a mortgage doesn't mean you're the kind of person that's going to stay for that long, and that's the key. It's the human dimension of the mortgage crisis that Alex brings home. Alex Kotlowitz, contributor to the New York Times Magazine and author of three books, including There Are No Children Here, the story of two boys growing up in the other America, profiling Cleveland there, where there are an estimated 10 to 15,000 abandoned homes due to the current mortgage crisis.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm with Farai today here in the studio. So let's say I just stamped on your food the word safe, the label safe. Would you feel safer about your food?
If you stamped it on, maybe not. But in general, I like, you know, clear cues.
Well, in a few moments, we're going to talk with the New York Times' Kim Severson about organic food and eating healthy. The organic label means, well, less or more than meets the eye. Give us a call to tell us how you're managing your food safety in this economy, what you're buying, what you're looking for. Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And now we turn to more political news from a state known for its windy politics. Voters in Illinois selected the Democratic candidate to replace Congressman Rahm Emanuel, who resigned his seat to become President Obama's chief of staff. With the vote still coming in, it looks like Cook County Commissioner Mike Quigley won the primary. Joining us now, we've got Chicago Public Radio reporter Tony Arnold. And Tony, what does Quigley's win signal? Was it a surprise?
It wasn't so much a surprise, but really, when you look at this race, we had 23 candidates running. A dozen of them were all Democrats. And when you had that many candidates in a special primary, turnout, we all kind of knew turnout was going to be extremely low, which made for an extremely close and tight race. It was highly competitive, and really not many people even knew that this race was going on. But when you talk to Mike Quigley, and last night he was posed the question of, you know, when you had this many candidates and this little time to really prepare a campaign, what do you do? What do you do to distinguish yourself? And this is, I think we have a little bit of tape here of his response.
I got to tell you, I respectfully think you don't do it during the campaign. I think you do it for 10 years of fighting the good fight against the status quo and for change and reform at Cook County.
So there was Commissioner Quigley. He was at a bar outside of Wrigley Field where his party was, and you know he gets to the point of battling corruption and kind of his tenure on the county board, which has been pretty tumultuous with some of the leadership of the county board, which I don't want to get too hyper local, but it's actually got a long history of patronage hiring and a lot of kind of wasteful spending on the government side of things. And Quigley has a widely known for having a reputation of going against the grain and fighting kind of the leadership of the county, of the Cook County government. And he really was able to capitalize on that for this campaign.
Now, we're going to talk about Rod Blagojevich in a second. But
sure.
Blago is a character. Rahm Emanuel is a character. Is Quigley a big character or just, you know, kind of more of a normal guy type?
He is definitely not so much. I would not put him in the same ballpark as a Rahm Emanuel or Rod Blagojevich. That's for sure.
Ballpark or comic book, I suppose.
Book. They're kind of in leagues of their own. Yeah. Actually,
Rahm
they're
is an action figure. Different. I'll have you know.
There you go.
But that being said, Quigley has a reputation for being very outspoken, and you know the key word for his campaign was reformer. And he ran, you know, this was everywhere you saw the name Quigley, you saw the word reformer, along with a picture of the Cook County Board president, who is a very unpopular, kind of in terms of unpopular political characters in Illinois. You have Rod Blagojevich far and away number one. Not too far behind is the president of the Cook County Board that is kind of Quigley's nemesis now. And so you had these two images going against each other that Quigley, you know, used in his campaign. That being said, he ran against two very powerful state senators from Illinois who have a long history of going against Rod Blagojevich. And so really you had these three all Democrats in a heavily Democratic district all going at each other trying to say, you know, no, I've been battling corruption longer than you have in this horribly corrupt state. And it really made for some interesting dynamics throughout the campaign.
Let's talk. You know what? I actually want to hear from a little bit more of this race. The turnout was really low, and you spoke to some voters. Here's how one of them responded. And this is Leo Klein, who's not a supporter of Quigley.
We have an embarrassment of riches, okay? But we're in the city of Chicago, and we expect people to be progressive in this city. But we want them, in addition to being progressive, we want them to be independent as well. At least that's what I want.
Okay. What was turnout like and who showed up? You know, I mean, this is a big seat.
Right. Far and away, the bulk of the people that I talked to when I said, you know, I would just kind of approach them on the subway or even coming out of voting places, out of libraries, and say, did you happen to vote today? And I got so many looks of just kind of vote for what? What's going on? I think that's the case in many special primaries around the country. That's not necessarily unique to Chicago. But that being said, you know, when you have 23 candidates and everyone's trying to remind each other, like trying to remind all the voters to get out there, go to the polls, and you know, it didn't work out. And all said,
it must be
all
a little
said
boring
and done.
For it, but Tony, I was just thinking about what you were saying. I mean, you know, everyone's campaigning against corruption. I mean, possibly, yeah. You know, maybe people are turned off because there's no traditional pro-corruption candidate like they usually would be.
There's definitely been a lot of talk as to you know. What it is that would not bring people to the polls? Are people just kind of tired in Illinois of all of this, of being the center of attention around the country for our politics? It didn't end with Blagojevich. You know, now there's still more going on with Senator Roland Burris, and he's still getting national headlines. So there's definitely this idea that voter fatigue definitely took its toll on this race, and in particular in this district being home to Rod Blagojevich and Rahm Emanuel, and there's a former congressman, Dan Rostenkowski, who ran the district for 30-some years and was arrested.
Just one question, literally one word. Are people buzzing about the Blago book deal?
I think the big thing is what is he going to title it? What's the title for the book? That's the real debate.
And I say, how about I did it my way? That's Tony Arnold, reporter for Chicago Public Radio. Thanks so much. And now we go to Femi Okeh with the news.
Thank you, Farai. The time is just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir for crimes against humanity and war crimes. It's the first time a sitting head of state has been charged. The US has called the conflict in Sudan's Darfur region a genocide, but judges at the ICC say they don't have enough evidence for genocide charges. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the West Bank today, meeting with Palestinian leaders. She says the peace process there is especially meaningful to her.
I will remain personally engaged. This is a commitment that I carry in my heart, not just in my portfolio as Secretary of State.
Secretary Clinton also criticized Israel's demolition of Palestinian homes in Jerusalem. In Afghanistan, the country's election commission has announced that the presidential election will take place in August. That's against the wishes of President Hamid Karzai, who wanted them to go ahead on schedule next month. The commission said it was maintaining the August date because of security and logistical problems. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea. We're about to talk with Kim Severson about whether organic food is actually safe food. So that made us think about how hard it is to choose healthy food these days. Katie from Detroit emailed us to say, I've been trying to make as much from scratch as possible, as well as frequenting my local farmers markets. It's healthier, tastier, and much less expensive. So let's talk about safe and unsafe food. They've been staples in our diets and our kitchens. I'm talking about tomatoes, spinach, and peanut butter, just to name some of the foods that have been tainted by E. coli or salmonella. Food-related illnesses, some of them fatal, have sparked nationwide concerns over food safety. And it's generally thought you can assure your food is safe by buying organic, free of preservatives and the like. Even the president is worried, especially about peanut butter.
That's what Sasha eats for lunch, probably three times a week. And, you know, I don't want to have to worry about whether she's going to get sick as a consequence of having her lunch.
New York Times reporter Kim Severson did some digging and found out that organic certification is not necessarily a guarantee of food safety. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Hey, Kim.
I'm doing great. How's our food doing?
Well, it depends on what you eat. News has not been good on the food front, and you know, with the peanut butter scares got everybody worried. It's this idea that if it was in the package, somehow it was safe, you know, that if it was in that nice, clean package, and peanut butter has certainly climbed over that wall. Now, organic food, I think a lot of people were surprised to find organic food on that list, the list of 3,000 items that are now being recalled. There's a sense that there's a halo, you know, that organic food is safer somehow. And, you know, organic does not necessarily mean pathogen-free, although I think there was a time back before the federal government got involved, back before organics became a $20 billion business, that organics perhaps meant a little something about food safety. I'm not sure that's always the case now, although certainly there are some very fine organic products.
But for my biology class, it would make sense that with fewer preservatives, they'd be more likely of having pathogens in there. I mean, duh, I'm just a high school biology student.
Well, a lot of what happens is food processing is when pathogens, and we saw that with E. coli. So here you have something that maybe if you ate something in a day or two would be fine, or if you didn't have cows that were eating corn and getting sick and developing this E. coli bacteria in their stomach, then, you know, they eliminate that. It runs onto the crops. We eat the crops. So, you know, you could argue that big agriculture has made food inherently unsafe in some ways. But then you also have this organic spinach thing gets put in a bag. The bag sits around for 10 or 12 days and gets shipped across the country. Lots of time for that E. coli to grow. So this is an overall system that builds in problems.
What is the state of regulation? I mean, is this something that has where the laws are good, but they're not being enforced, or where the laws are problematic?
I think there's some really good organic food inspectors. There's some people who are true believers who came out of the organic movement, who helped the organic laws get codified. In 2002 is when we got our federal organic standards, and you started to see those little green and white labels on the packaging. There are a lot of people who are on the advisory board for those. A lot of good inspectors out there, people who approach it like a CSI episode, and they look to see if certain crops are coming up too soon. Maybe that's an indication that pesticides are being used. They do investigative work, and they really do assure that the food is going according to the labels.
So there's like a spinach SWAT team
yes,
of
there
folks?
Is.
There really is?
They wear black, and they're in the fields. You can't really see them. but at the same time, this system is set up so that if I have something and I'm like, I want an organic seal, I pay a guy to come out, look at my fields, double check things, check my paperwork, and give me organic certification. Then I pay them every year to keep that up. So there's a certain incentive for the inspectors to make sure that that farm is certified. Do things, you know, mess up? Well, in the case of the peanut factories, yeah, things got messed up.
The metal shavings thing really got to me, hearing that some of the peanuts that had gone through various factories had metal shavings in them.
Metal shavings trouble you more than, like, bug parts?
Yeah, because
okay.
You know,
in many countries,
bugs are a form of protein.
That's true.
We could get into
that's
that.
True.
Fried crickets
that's
in
true.
You know West
that's
and
true.
Southern
ant
Africa.
Ant larva is you know Mexican.
Yeah,
in certain regions of Mexico.
The big worm that you kind of eat as a, you know. Anyway,
the tapeworm.
Centipede.
Right.
Nah, it's something like Mapano. But anyway,
delicious.
What is our takeaway from this? Would you say? I mean, for people who are trying to be choosy shoppers,
I think you know where your food comes from. I personally like to shop as close to where I live as I can. That's not always possible for people. Five ingredients or less on the label is a good thing. And, you know, just be careful and all else fails, have a cheeseburger.
But on one little point there, the information that we need, maybe the information we need is how far removed from the actual picking in the field any given organic food substance is. That is the mystery.
Yeah,
you don't know. It all looks beautiful in the store, but there's a wide range of how old it actually is.
Right. There's a long supply chain and something, or you have to decide, do I want something organic from Chile or do I want something that's not organic that's, you know, from the Hudson Valley.
Maybe that's the change. Maybe that's the change that needs to be made. Maybe we need to know more about that.
Probably true.
How does this relate to socioeconomics as well? Because one of the things that someone said to me many years ago, and now there's some activism around this, is that if you live in the hood, you're not getting organic. I mean, there's no question. Whatever you get, you know, it's probably in a package to begin with. You don't get fresh foods as much. But even if you do get it, organics are not as much on the table. That's changing a little bit. But what do you see in this economy as a trend for organics, which are often more high priced?
Right, well, we're certainly seeing organics soften. You know, it was double-digit growth every year. Now it's slowed down, maybe 9% growth every year, which is, you know, still quite a bit. I think you're finding that people need to make different food choices. I do think, you know, obviously, if you're on a budget, that gallon of organic milk is going to seem like a choice you're not going to make. But then, you know, you look at all the money that we spend on, you know, expensive coffees, we spend on our cell phones, we spend on downloading certain songs. For me, I'd rather have, some organic food than, you know, the latest, ringtone for my cell phone. But those are choices we all make at all economic levels.
Thanks so much. And that is New York Times reporter Kim Severson doing some digging on organic foods.
And appearing on our website.
Absolutely.
In video, yes.
Absolutely.
Go see it. Go check it out.
We live in many dimensions.
Yes, indeed. So does Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Good morning. 21 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown will speak about the economy before a joint session of Congress today. The British newspaper The Guardian is calling it, I'm going to quote The Guardian here, possibly the most important of his political life, end of quote. Brown's approval ratings have slid recently. Analysts say his visit to the popular American president could provide a political boost. Femi Okeh says that's a little over the top for that speech. Meanwhile, home sales were up 7% last year. That's because there were so many foreclosed homes on the auction block. The number of all of those foreclosed homes in the market called motivated sales went up 177% last year. And that's significant because it shows that foreclosed homes are becoming a much larger part of the housing market. In California, a ski patrol member was killed yesterday in an avalanche at a ski resort near Lake Tahoe. He was working on avalanche controls when he was caught in a slide and partially buried. A winter storm had dumped several feet of snow on the region. And the Red Cross is appealing for both sides of the Sri Lankan civil war to actually stop fighting to allow them to get aid to civilians. That's a look at news.
Markets on Wall Street open and up. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I am Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. In this morning, news that the International Criminal Court, as expected in The Hague, has issued a warrant for the arrest of sitting Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, first warrant ever issued by the court against a serving head of state. Three judges approved bringing him to trial over the government's actions in Darfur. He'll answer seven counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, but the court rejected a further accusation of genocide. Joining us now is BBC Africa editor Martin Plaut from London. Martin, first of all, thanks for joining us. And this is a test both of the court and also of the officials inside Sudan who are close to Omar al-Bashir. The question being, will they stick with him or will they distance themselves and possibly will things unfold into chaos in Khartoum?
Well, that has been suggested in the past. To be honest with you, I haven't seen any indication that that is the case. I think it's stupid to try and predict what will happen, but I've never seen any real split in the ranks. I mean, there seems to be a great deal of support for the president. There are demonstrators on the streets of Khartoum as we speak, denouncing Mr. Ocampo, the chief prosecutor. There's a sort of picture of him as a pig with his face on where the head would be, which could be hardly more insulting from an Arabic crowd. So, there seems to be a great deal of support for the president at the moment inside Sudan.
So what is the point of this international court warrant? I mean, there's a trial that will proceed. There will be a sort of a showcase for self-congratulatory Westerners, but the situation in Darfur will grind on and Bashir will be more popular than ever.
Well, I don't think it's quite as simple as that. I'm not sure that you can have a show trial without the Mr. Bashir being there. But, it's not just a question of Westerners. The judges who you know, have made this decision come from Ghana, Latvia, and Brazil. And there are a number of non-Western countries who have supported this. But the decision now really transfers to the UN Security Council, which could put aside this judgment for 12 months. But here again, the UN is deeply split, with China and Russia on the one hand saying, no, let's, you know, sort of, yes, let's issue this decision to put it off for 12 months, and the Western states mostly saying, no, no, we need to now see justice.
Meanwhile, though, it appears that the president's freedom of movement may not be restricted, as nations around Sudan have at least tacitly or in some cases explicitly said they will not enforce the arrest warrant if Omar al-Bashir should travel to their region.
Indeed. But then, you know, the situation of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe is quite analogous. He's quite free to travel to South Africa because they don't, have any sanctions against him. But he can't travel to Europe. And world leaders love traveling. Their wives like it even more. And, you know, frankly, they don't like being seen as pariahs. They want to be welcomed in international capitals wherever they go. And, you know, one shouldn't forget that Sudan and the United States were actually quite close to each other quite recently. After all, they shared intelligence material against al-Qaeda. There was quite a lot of rapport between the two states. Now they seem to be at daggers drawn over this particular issue. So the question is really where this all goes. Will Sudan move towards the radical Islamic side of things? It's something that's been threatened by some of their senior leaders, or won't they?
Right. And at the very least, a test of international law here and the International Criminal Court itself. Martin Plaut, BBC Africa editor, joined us from London. A warrant has been issued for sitting President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. The combination of guns and drugs is a toxic brew for our next guest. The Arizona Attorney General joins us in a moment after headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. Time just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Obama administration is kicking off a new program designed to help up to 9 million borrowers stay in their homes through refinance mortgages or loans that are modified to lower monthly payments. So to help borrowers work out if they are eligible, the government has placed assessment tools on a website, and here's the website address, financialstability.gov. That's financialstability.gov. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the West Bank today. She's promising to be personally involved in jump-starting stalled Middle East peace efforts. She also criticized Israel's demolition of Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem, and Israel says the homes were built illegally. An arrest warrant is out for the killer of Chandra Levy, and that's a 24-year-old woman who vanished while jogging in a DC park back in 2001. Jeffrey Taylor, an attorney for the District of Columbia, confirmed the identity of the man police believed killed Levy.
A judge of the Superior Court for the District of Columbia signed an arrest warrant charging 27-year-old Ingmar Gwandiki for first-degree murder in the death of Chandra Levy.
And Gwandiki is currently serving time for attacking two other women, and the case, of course, stumped investigators for years.
Indeed. It happened during the summer before 9/11. It takes us way, way back. Thank you, Femi. So if you're in Arizona, say the town of Phoenix, and are at the AZ Shooters World browsing the firearms and sporting goods at that facility, you might notice that right around the corner from you, it's possible that a transaction is taking place that's part of the Mexican drug war going on right in your presence. Listen to Don Langworthy.
Oftentimes it'll happen where a male and a female will come in together. The female, you know, stands off to the side quietly, shows no interest in the guns, and then after the male determines what he wants to purchase, will, you know, call the female over to start filling out the paperwork.
Don Langworthy, who's the gun manager at AZ Shooters World in Phoenix, is describing the process called straw buyers, who may be buying guns using multiple people, one person who knows about guns, the other person who can pass the various federal tests and paperwork exams required to purchase guns. But those guns end up in Mexico, where there is essentially open warfare between the Mexican government of Felipe Calderon and drug cartels who have had a free hand in the border region up until now. And that violence is visible in many cases from some of the border towns here in the United States. Joining me is Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard, who's on the phone from Washington, D.C., who is in some sense the man in the middle here, someone who understands the gun culture and gun politics of the state of Arizona, a conservative state, but yet who also understands the instability and the threats that exist as the drug war continues just south of the border. First of all, Mr. Attorney General, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Describe the conflict and contradictions here in your job, enforcing gun laws in Arizona, but yet preventing instability because of those guns being shipped south of the border.
Well, it's actually pretty straightforward. We have anti-straw buyer regulations in federal law, and we're enforcing those using state laws against false document preparation. It's a firearm transfer form, 4473, that everyone has to fill out if they're buying a pistol or a long gun, and they have to say what the purpose is. And the illegal purpose would be to give it to someone else, as in the case that you just had in your clip, who intends to take it to Mexico. Now, it's illegal to have an AK-47, for example, in Mexico as a civilian. And so it's a violation of that country's laws, but it's also a violation of the laws of the United States to lie on the form. And there's a case that started yesterday in Phoenix that one individual was involved in a great many what the Mexican authorities call weapons of war being sold to straw buyers and then transferred to Mexico. I think we have a strong self-interest in the United States, particularly in the border states, to try to do everything we can to stop the incredible border violence just south of the border from the cartels.
Now, you're describing a situation where if people lie on their form, they can be arrested. But is the state of the law such that if somebody just said, well, actually, I want to sell this gun down in Mexico where there's a drug war, and that was the truth, that you could do nothing with them?
If they said it was for personal use, we can do nothing with them. If they said they were to resell it illegally in another country, no, that's not correct.
But what if they just said for personal use down in Mexico? And we all know what that would mean.
If it was for resale, then that would be a violation. There's not a provision under U.S. law for that to take place. If you said it was for hunting and it could have been in various places, that would not be a violation. But what we're talking about is large volumes. This is not a casual purchaser. This is not a collector. These are people that are buying literally hundreds of AK-47s and various other firearms which are used in warfare.
Now, let's describe for a moment what contributors and reporters on this program have discussed really all week long, and that there is some sort of culture clash between the availability or apparent availability of guns in a place like Arizona and the war that's going on between the cartels. Do you think there is a clash of cultures here on either side of the border and that it is enabling these guns to get in the hands of militants?
Well, I think the clash, as the Mexican officials have pointed out, is between the ready availability of weapons in the United States and the almost non-availability of similar weapons to civilians in Mexico. But frankly, if people who are avid hunters, fishermen, avid gun collectors that I've talked to have absolutely no time for somebody illegally purchasing a weapon just for export, for making money off of selling it illegally in another country. The National Shooting Sports Foundation has a program called Don't Lie for the Other Guy, and they are promoting that across the country, basically saying when you're filling out the form, tell the truth. It is a felony crime not to do that. So what you just had on your clip from Shooter's World is a responsible gun seller basically following the law and making sure that somebody is not coming into his store and filling out a form for somebody else, for a straw buyer.
This is Farai, and I just wanted to ask this question. It seemed to me when I first started reading about this situation that I've met several Mexican immigrants in America who feel that the U.S. is not taking enough responsibility for what happens along the border. Is there any resentment of the U.S. in this process of the guns entering Mexico?
I think there's a great deal of concern. I can't speak for resentment. There may be by some, but the Attorney General of Mexico, Eduardo Medina Mora, at several conferences basically said the thing that he needed most from the United States was assistance in enforcing our gun laws, not changing them, but enforcing them, that would cut down on the number of very, very serious weapons that are basically allowing the cartels to have more firepower than the police and the army in Mexico. And that's something I think we all have an interest in assuring and helping the country of Mexico in a desperate battle against some of the best armed paramilitary in the world.
Well, I have to say that if the main weapon, and you've outlined it here, is a campaign to urge people not to lie on the form, you know, sportsmen don't lie for the other guy. I mean, what militant in Mexico is going to pay any attention to that?
Well, it's not the militant in Mexico we're focused on. It's the purchaser in the United States and the arms sellers. If they will follow the law, fill out the forms accurately, we're going to do a great deal to cut down on the illegal sales to Mexico. It probably would not stop it in all realism, but it would stop the hundreds of AK-47s, for example, from going across the border, which is unfortunately the situation today. These weapons are showing up at crime scenes in Mexico. Some brutal assassinations have been traced back to gun stores in Phoenix, and that's something that I believe we have a responsibility to cut back on, stop if we can.
He is the man in the middle there as American guns bought in Arizona are inflaming the drug wars in Mexico. I want to thank Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard for joining us from Washington. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farah Jadeya. We talked with the New York Times' Kim Severson about whether organic food means safe food. Did she convince you?
I think she was very honest about the challenge.
Yes, indeed, and which is a good reason for you to podcast that. You can hear it on our website at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Some of you have written to say how you make safe food choices. Polly from Winnipeg writes in an email to say she's eating vegan, don't want to eat whatever's been put into animals, and like knowing I'm helping the environment. We want to hear from you on anything we talk about on the program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And here's a tragic takeaway from Cleveland, Ohio.
What's kind of astonishing to me, they're even taking the cement slabs now from the front steps. I mean, it's as if the city has literally had its legs knocked out from under them.
That's Alex Kotlowitz, contributor to the New York Times Magazine, describing the state of foreclosures in Cleveland. 10 to 15,000 homes simply abandoned. And if you missed our conversation with Alex or the Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard on guns moving from Phoenix to Mexico, go ahead and sign up for our podcast, or you can go directly to our website.
I'm Farah Jadeya.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.